When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With the Baker's Plus card, it's easy to get lower than low prices. For the win! Earn fuel points on every purchase and save up to $1 a gallon at the pump. The Baker's Plus card. All you do is win. Big, big savings. Sign up now at bakersplus.com and start saving. Baker's. Fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your favorites with the Buy 5 or More Save $1 Each sale. Simply buy 5 or more participating items and save $1 each with your card. Baker's, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and now heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate welcomes Carrie Janelle to discuss Milton Brown, the father of Texas swing, who mentored Bob Wills and invented the genre that combined jazz with traditional Texas string band music. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today I'm joined by Carrie Janelle, author of Milton Brown and the Founding of Western Swing. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Nate.
And thank you. This book really opened my eyes. I was aware of Milton Brown. I'd had the complete CDs for 10, 15 years. I had enjoyed it, but I'd never really realized the extent to which he really is the true father of Western Swing.
Yes, that was the summation that I came up with after doing all the research. It was a very interesting journey for me to discover this, especially growing up as a Bob Wills fan.
And this has no mark on Bob Wills whatsoever. Milton and Bob, of course, were in the Light Crust Doughboys together, Pappy Leo Daniel's group at the Burroughs Mills, but Milton left the Light Crust Doughboys first and was well out ahead of Bob Wills for the entire rest of his life.
I think that the key to understanding each man's place in the history of the music is to understand their personalities. Milton Brown was a guy who knew how to organize things. He knew how to manage things. He knew how to plan. He had a business sense. He was schooled. He went to high school and graduated from high school, something that not very many Texans did. Bob Wills was strictly an instinctive musician. They both shared a great amount of charisma, but Bob Wills was not a businessman, and he proved that over and over again over his career. So as a result, it took a while for him to get jump started, and by that time, Milton was leagues ahead of him.
And he was. And it's funny, you know, to look back and realize that Milton never had a national hit and he never wrote a hit song. A few of his songs have been covered. A few of the songs that he did that he introduced into the Western String repertoire went on to be covered by Bob Wills and Cliff Bruner and on into George Strait. But Milton's importance, it's not as a songwriter and it's not as a major star. Sum up in a few sentences, why is Milton Brown so important?
Milton Brown was important basically because there were very few people in popular music history who single-handedly created a music genre. And it's not being too expansive to say this. When you have people like Bill Monroe basically inventing bluegrass all by himself, he was one of the very few examples. But Milton Brown took a Texas string band tradition and expanded it and literally brought it uptown, combining it with urban music sources such as jazz and pop music, combining that with traditional rural, white rural instrumentation. He developed the repertoire, he developed the instrumentation, he grew the size of the music, and he took it from small fiddle and guitar dances in private residences into ballrooms. And this is what he recognized what was going on in popular music in the 1930s, and he jumped on it. So that was the important part. What Milton did not survive to do was see the music change. As a music genre develops, the first thing that happens is that the music style is established, but the repertoire is still in a nascent stage. So what you do in that case is take traditional sources or you take sources from other genres. And it wasn't until the late 1930s and the early 1940s when Western swing developed its own songwriters, when you had people like Floyd Tillman and Cyndi Walker writing for the genre. That didn't happen for a while. By that time, Milton had been dead.
Yeah, and there's every indication that Milton could have developed into a songwriter. He wrote quite a few songs of his own, some of which are adaptations of other songs, but it wasn't for lack of talent. It was simply that there were so many great jazz and blues songs and pop songs to bring into the repertoire that it wasn't a priority. And the record industry was absolutely dead for his entire career. It basically fell off a cliff in 1931, between 29 and 32. The record industry essentially died. And so live radio performances and live performances were the way to reach audiences in this period. And that's what Milton did. I love the way you describe the book. You break it down and you say it's essentially not just the story of a man, although there's a quote that I've got to share, that you describe Milton Brown as a man with a vision, a man whose love for people and instinct for entertainment drove him to cast aside traditions in one ambitious move after another. I want to let you elaborate on that, but first, it's also a story of a family, and it's a story of his musicians, and we'll talk about that first. But go back to that quote. Describe his vision, and this, I love this line, a man whose love for people. How did that drive him to cast aside traditions?
Milton lived for his live shows, his dance band. The musical Brownie's career did not depend on radio or records as much as for his live dates. As far as Milton was concerned, the records and the radio performances were meant to promote his live dates. And he just enjoyed entertaining people. He had the gift of gab. He started out his career after graduating from high school as a salesman, a traveling salesman. He sold just about anything. And he enjoyed meeting people and getting to know them. And I was really kind of charmed by the stories that I heard from the people who actually saw him at dances. I was able to interview some of them. And they treated him like he was a member of their family, but he was also a god to them. They just idolized Milton. And they would love nothing better than to invite him over after a dance to their house for a homemade chicken dinner. And he just loved socializing with people in addition to entertaining them. And he never had an enemy. You've heard the statement, so-and-so never met a friend. Well, that's what Milton Brown was like. He had friends. So it was that love for people that drove him on. His ambitions, it's really unclear what his long-term goals were for his role in the entertainment industry, because things were changing so quickly in the 1930s. He was only able to communicate his next step as opposed to five steps down the road.
Yeah, but you make it clear that he was thinking ahead. He was looking at movies. He was very much watching the Texas Centennial and ready to participate, pushing himself forward as someone who would be available and ready to participate in a big way in the big celebrations at the State Fair and in DFW at that time. But you also say it's a story of a family. And this quote is really touching. It's the story of a family that limped into the 20th century on their hands and knees in the cotton fields, sharecroppers, the oldest son rising in his profession, threatened by the Depression. And I want to play a song. And when I come back, I'll let you expand on the family's role and the socio-cultural context of Milton Brown. But let's go ahead and hear the musical Brownies. This is a song, Yes Sir, that features a piano solo, and you can hear the jazz style slap bass all the way through it. And this is one that you flagged as really showing off the musical Brownies and kind of how intensely they could swing. This is Yes Sir by Milton Brown and the musical Brownies.
That she was single, yes sir.
Yes sir.
When that man walked in the flat and he hollered out, "Who is that? Did I leave you without my hat?" Yes sir.
Yes sir.
Oh, sir. Yeah. Did I quit my misbehaving? Yes sir.
Yes sir.
Is my razor just for shaving? Yes sir.
And that was Yes Sir by Milton Brown and his musical Brownies. And it's so, you know, we take it for granted that country bands these days are going to have drums, they're going to have keyboards, they're going to have sometimes horns. But when Milton Brown brought piano and stand-up bass into a Western string band, this was completely novel. These were lines being obliterated.
Yeah, and they were just happenstance, too. When Fred Calhoun joined the group, it was an accident. He had arrived to play on the radio, and he heard by word of mouth that, hey, you have to go out to this dance hall on the edge of town and listen to this Milton Brown band. They've got really good rhythm. You might fit in with them. And when Milton met him, he brought Fred out onto the bandstand to play a number, and they played Nobody's Sweetheart Now, which is a hot jazz tune. And at the reaction of the crowd, Milton instinctively knew that a piano had to be added to his band, not only for the rhythm, but for the added melodic interpretations that Fred Calhoun added. And that was the first regular piano player added to a Western band. So that's what he did. He recognized opportunities when they came up. The same thing happened when Bob Dunn came along and when he decided to add twin fiddles to his band. All of these instrumental innovations came because he recognized something that would make his band better.
And let's switch gears and go back to his family background, because, you know, going back to the beginning of the 20th century, the extent of rural white poverty in that era is something that's really kind of unrecognizable now. It was something that was basically eliminated after World War II. I mean, there's still obviously poor rural white people, but not as many as there were then. Describe kind of the hard scrabble growth and development of Milton Brown and his family.
Well, they were country people. They were from a small town called Stephenville, which was about 60 miles southwest of Fort Worth. And they got by. They weren't poor, but they were far from wealthy as well. Milton's father worked at a peanut factory, and on weekends, nights and weekends, he was a champion fiddle player, and so he used to play for house dances. And sometimes he'd bring Milton along, and Milton might do the calls, or eventually he would start singing a song. But Milton was – the Brown family was very family-oriented. They were very, very close. And they were made even closer after Milton's older sister died mysteriously at the age of 16 in 1918, which is what drove them to leave Stephenville and move to the city of Fort Worth. But Milton, above all, wanted to help his family out. His father was getting on in years. He wasn't able to work very much anymore. And Milton became, at the age of 22, the breadwinner of the family. Now, he didn't graduate from high school until he was 22. That's because he had to work while going to school at the same time in order to help his family out. So family was extremely important to Milton, and he never let them down.
And Milton struggled with some childhood health issues of his own that you think might have been a contributing factor to his early death.
It's possible. I consulted a few doctors about what I suspect was his narcolepsy, which is falling asleep at a moment's notice without warning. He was not a very good driver, but this was traced back to an attack of appendicitis that he had when he was a boy, and he almost died from it. And appendicitis, severe appendicitis like this, could bring on these attacks of having to fall asleep very quickly. So nothing's been confirmed. There were no medical records available, no doctor on hand that I could question to find out how they diagnosed this. So it was mainly guesswork, but there were puzzle pieces that fit together to form a logical solution to how this accident that killed him in 1936 occurred. A lot of people have assumed that he was drinking while he was driving. But when I interviewed several members of the Musical Brownies who were with him that night, Milton had admitted to them that he wasn't drinking that night because he had a sour stomach. Something had disagreed with him and he wasn't drinking. So he wasn't drunk. So that kind of gave rise to another factor that he had fallen asleep at the wheel of his car.
Tragic. And let's go ahead and get to his adulthood. And one of the key meetings in his life is when he meets Bob Wills and guitarist Herman Arnspringer. Tell us how they met and how their partnership developed.
Back in those days, house dances were very important to the families in Fort Worth. A lot of them, like the Browns, had moved from the country, and they took that tradition with them. Milton would sing at these square dances, and he ran across Bob Wills and Herman Arnspringer, who were a fiddle and guitar duo, at a house dance at the Eagles Hall in New York. In Fort Worth. Milton just stepped up and heard a song that he knew, which was St. Louis Blues, and he started singing with him. So it was, again, as we said before, happenstance. They decided to team up together.
And Milton's little brother, Durwood, tagged along. He was quite young at the time, but he's a very interesting character, and he becomes basically Milton Brown's right-hand man, will eventually take over the band after Milton's passing. Tell us a little bit about Durwood and his personality and how it differed from Milton's.
Well, Durwood was a different kind of guy. He's the guy that would put up his fists at a moment's notice in order to defend himself or somebody that he knew. Milton was more of the guy who would try and talk his way out of difficulties. So Durwood would get into scrapes every now and then, and Milton was almost like he wasn't just an older brother, he was almost like a father figure to Durwood, because he was so much older than him. Milton was born in 1903 and Durwood was born in 1915. So there was a 12-year difference between them. So he protected him as much as he could. But when Durwood started to play guitar, then Milton thought, hey, that would be a great thing to add to our little trio with Wills and Arnspringer. So he brought him along.
And the rest is history. Tell us a little bit about their first break with WBAP and how they became the Aladdin Laddies.
One thing that I discovered about Milton Brown's career is it didn't start with the Lightcrest Doughboys. He had been a paid performer since the mid-1920s, since the time that he got out of high school. He joined together with two friends, and they became a vocal trio. And they originally called themselves the Three Yodeliers. But in getting sponsorships back in those days, your sponsor helped give you your group name. So they never had a regular name. When they did a show for the Rock Island Railroad, they called themselves the Rock Island Rockets. When they did a benefit for the Fort Worth Police Department, they called themselves the police quartet, adding another member. So whatever sponsor that Milton could find affected the name of the group. And when they finally got onto radio, they were able to get the Aladdin Lamp Company, which made kerosene lamps, to sponsor them. And so at this point, they named themselves the Aladdin Laddies. They were even, and there's an image of this ad in the book. There was a laboratory that produced vaccines, very timely for today, in fact, called the Globe Laboratories. And so when that happened on radio, Milton became Milton Brown and his Globetrotters. That was the sponsor for the group. So when the Light Crust Doughboys started, that was just another in this long line of sponsorships. This was the one that hit it big because Light Crust Flour was a big company in the town of Fort Worth.
Let's go ahead and hear our next song. This is Right or Wrong, which has been in the Western Swing repertoire up until the present day, covered by George Strait. This is Milton Brown and the Musical Brownies doing Right or Wrong.
You, though you're gone, I can't forget. Right or wrong, I'll keep on dreaming till I wake with the same old regret. All along, I thought I'd lose you. Still I pray that you'd be true. In your heart, please just remember, right or wrong, I'm still in love with you.
That was Milton Brown and the Musical Brownies doing Right or Wrong, a song he didn't write, but he did very much introduce into the Western String repertoire. Now, tell us about the Light Crust Doughboys. They get an opportunity to go and be on KFJZ and work with, sponsored by the Light Crust Flour Company, Burris Mills. Tell us about Pappy Leo Daniel and how he became involved with the group and what his initial reaction to Milton and his music was.
Originally, the Light Crust Doughboys had as their announcer the station engineer. His name was Truett Kimsey. And once that they went on the air, they were getting very good response from the audience. But the general manager, the sales manager, W. Leo Daniel, didn't like the music at all. And in fact, he canceled the program, because he hated hillbilly music and he hated dance music. He knew that wouldn't be good for his image. So what O'Daniel did, once the fan mail started coming in complaining that the Doughboys had been dropped, he went on the air and took over as the spokesman and manager. He recognized that this would be a good vehicle to promote himself. I mean, O'Daniel was a guy who had huge ambitions, political ambitions, and looked for every opportunity he could to promote himself. And so that's what he was using Light Crust Flour and the Light Crust Doughboys for doing for his career. So he decided to start writing poetry and adapting songs with his poems and using the Light Crust Doughboys to promote himself. He didn't want to give anybody any other credit for their musicianship. So none of the musicians, even Milton Brown's real names, were used on the air. Milton became the boy with the golden voice. So that's how that worked. Eventually, he knew that he could expand his influence beyond Fort Worth. So he formed a radio network, Texas's first radio network. Bought a small bus, and started touring around the state while performing. So it was O'Daniel that really spread the popularity of the Light Crust Doughboys more than anything else could.
But at the same time, he's distorting their material by discouraging the hot jazz and the dance numbers and encouraging a more maudlin sort of traditional songcraft.
There are some existing scripts I have a few of those of what the Doughboys program was like. It was all scripted, by the way. But the songs were not the hot jazz. It wasn't Nobody's Sweetheart and Chinese Honeymoon and Right or Wrong and that sort of thing. It were songs of home and hearth, sacred songs, songs about mom, songs about sad deaths, event ballads, things like that. Things that would not, I guess you could say, disrupt people's view of what the music was supposed to be like.
But it wasn't musical difference that drove Milton away. It was tensions over trying to get his brother Durwood a job at the factory. Why did Milton split, and why did he not take Bob Wills with him?
Milton was earning $15 a week playing for W. Lee O'Daniel. But O'Daniel, as part of their agreement, demanded that not only did they play their daily broadcast, but they had to work at the mill also. So Milton Brown was a salesman. Bob Wills worked at the mill. Herman Arnspiger drove a truck. They did whatever they could there. And after a while, Milton thought he deserved a raise with all the money that he was bringing in for O'Daniel through his successful broadcasts. Now, Durwood had been playing along with them, but he was still only 14, 15 years old, and Milton wanted to get him as a paid musician on the job. So he went to O'Daniel and he said, look, I deserve a raise. I want more money, and I want you to hire Durwood also. Well, O'Daniel said, okay, I can give you a raise, but I can't use Durwood. I'm not going to pay him. And this was on a Friday when this happened. Milton had anticipated this was going to happen. This is what I think about what I say about taking one step ahead, thinking one step ahead. He was already with his own group. He started his own group, and they went on the air on a rival radio station on Monday morning.
Wow.
On KTAT. So he had his guys already there. Now, he may have asked Bob Wills to join him, but Bob had a good thing going. He had a job. He was playing on the radio. He was working at the mill. And he didn't feel like it was worth the risk to go off with Milton, an untried artist with his own brand new band, because Bob was very poor at the time, and so was Herman Arnspiger. So they both stayed with the Lightcrust Doughboys, and O'Daniel hired eventually Tommy Duncan to replace Milton in the band. But Milton thought it was good anyway, because Bob Wills wasn't Milton's kind of fiddle player. Milton was interested in hot jazz. He wasn't interested in the mom and God songs that O'Daniel wanted on the radio. He knew that the people wanted hot jazz, and he found two hot fiddle players to work with him. First, it was Jesse Ashlock, and then after a few months, he brought in Cecil Brower. And both of them could play improvised jazz solos, whereas Bob Wills could not. Bob Wills was strictly a breakdown fiddler. He played rags and breakdowns and hoedowns, and he wasn't really a schooled musician. He was an instinctive musician, which means that if he felt like adding another bar to another beat to a bar, he'd do it. And if you listen to Bob Wills's music, you can hear that some bars have five beats, some have three beats. He might wait seven beats before he comes in with his next vocal. So it's very hard for musicians to play along with Bob Wills. But the classically trained violinists, really, that Milton Brown brought with him, made it easier for dancers to be able to step with a beat, and Wills couldn't.
And not only does he have these fiddle players who are ready, willing, and able to play hot jazz improvised solos a la Louis Armstrong or Eddie Lang, somebody like that, he brings in a banjo player and a stand-up bass right away. So even before he later adds the piano and the steel guitar, he's already making it a very different style of band. And let's take a break to hear from our sponsors. And when we come back, we'll get you to tell us more about the musical brownies. So right from the get-go, Milton Brown's vision for the band is very different from what the Light Crust Doughboys had been or what anybody had done in Texas or anywhere in the West for that matter. And even just the matter of having a group that was led by a singer that featured vocals on almost every song was very atypical of music at the time and really revolutionary. Only Bing Crosby at that period of time was known as a featured singer. It wouldn't be until the 1940s that people like Frank Sinatra and Perry Como and Doris Day break away from bands and become star singers. This is very much a period when instrumental bands and arrangers dominate the scene. Milton was totally visionary in this and in the hot rhythms of the band. What were some of his musical influences that he was bringing to bear?
Well, again, Milton Brown was interested in playing for the relatively urban audience of Fort Worth. Now, Fort Worth was still a country town, but it was a large country town, and it had network radio programs, and he listened to the radio incessantly and listened to records. He wanted to know what people wanted to hear, what the popularity was at the time. This was a transitory period in popular music when jazz bands were starting to grow physically into larger and larger groups, and eventually by the mid-30s would develop into swing. So Milton would be hearing these records, but he didn't want to startle or alienate his audiences by adding in too many urban instruments such as horns. He didn't want clarinets, he didn't want trumpets, he didn't want trombones immediately. He wanted to do it with string instruments. So he would translate what he heard on these jazz records, these pop and jazz records, to the string band instrumentation. So if the lead might be played by a clarinet or a trumpet, he would have the violins play that. When he brought in the steel guitar was meant to imitate the sound of a trombone section with its multiple strings and its sliding ability. So that was what he was doing at the time. Now, as far as vocals were concerned, there were plenty of vocalists of dance bands that were popular. Bing Crosby was just one of them. Rudy Valley had his own dance band and was a very popular, well-known singer. Crooning had come in with the advent of the microphone in the mid-1920s. So vocalists were big stars at that time, but not in traditional Texas music. The vocal was limited to square dance calls at the time. There were solo cowboy singers that sang on the radio, people like Mark Williams, the crooning cowboy of Dallas and Fort Worth. But Milton was really the first major singer in Texas rural music. So that was the first innovation. After that came the twin violins. He felt that drums were a little bit too intrusive upon rural music. So he had other ways of adding rhythm. And that was through the rhythm section consisting of piano, slapping string bass, and the four-string banjo of O.C. Stockard. And that was as good, if not better, than drums, getting those three guys in a groove.
And Durwood Brown, too, who was apparently a ferocious rhythm guitar player notorious for constantly breaking strings.
Exactly. Yeah. Durwood Brown rounded out that section, the rhythm section as well. I mean, he could play lead guitar, and there are a few examples of that on record. But it's almost like he was falling downstairs when he was playing the guitar. He was much better at rhythm. And he played such hard rhythm that he would break strings on the bandstand all the time. And that required the third Brown brother to sit on the bandstand in a chair with a fresh guitar waiting for Durwood to break a string. And he would just hand him a new guitar and Durwood wouldn't even miss a beat. So he wouldn't even have to stop the song to change strings.
That's classic. And they rocked that 2-4 beat that we associate mostly with New Orleans jazz or Kansas City jazz later on down the road. That really must have got people dancing in Fort Worth at the time.
He knew that the 2-4 beat, the Dixieland beat, was what people needed to step with in order to do their dancing. This was strictly dance music. It was not music like music in the East where you sat down and listened to it. The purpose of Western swing music in those days was to dance. And so every song, even the waltzes, had to have a dance beat to it.
And they had basically a home base. tell us a little bit about the Crystal Springs Dance Hall.
Well, this was a dance hall that was built over a gravel pit. It was excavated by a guy named Sam Cunningham, who eventually accidentally discovered these natural springs, mineral springs, and he decided to build a resort there. And people in the summer would go there, and they'd swim, and they'd have dances, and it was a very nice place to vacation without really going very far out of town. So he started this dance hall, and Milton Brown came upon it when he was with Bob and Herman, and they started playing dances there. So initially, they played every night except Sunday. They were there at Crystal Springs at the Dancing Pavilion.
And they also,
when Milton split off from Bob and started his own band, he started booking jobs out of town, and he would only play maybe once or twice a week at Crystal Springs, Saturday night for sure, because that was the big dance night. But the rest of the week, he would go out of town and play little dance halls that dotted all across Texas.
And they were also being broadcast on radio. At first, it was KTAT, but pretty soon, Milton's being syndicated around the state as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't really call it being syndicated. He was on a network, which is kind of different than being syndicated. There was no radio syndication there, so to speak. It was just a network that had several radio stations in their hookup. And so he could be heard on more than one station at a time. He could be heard in Houston. He could be heard in San Antonio, as well as Fort Worth. So that was the Texas Quality Network that W.O. Daniel started up. So this helped promote Milton throughout the state, and the local dance halls would write to him and want him to book an appearance at their dance hall. So Milton, being the band's manager as well as the leader and singer, would arrange for these little tours occasionally where he might play for two or three nights at a time before coming back to Fort Worth. The problem was that initially he had this daily radio program that he had to do every day. So you could only go far enough away in order to be able to drive back after the dance, get a quick couple of hours sleep, and get up and go do your radio program. So it was a very hard life for them to be on the road 6 days a week, come back, play Crystal Springs, and just come back every single day on the bus and do your daily radio program. There were no transcriptions at that time. Radio transcriptions didn't start until after Milton had died, 1936. So he was forced to do all of his programs live.
And even though record sales were a very minor part of the music business in this era, Milton did sign record contracts and record with both Bluebird and then later on Decca Records. Tell us a little bit about his recording career and the style of stuff that he chose to cut from a very big repertoire of songs.
Well, Milton did have a very big repertoire of songs. That's true. When they first signed with Bluebird Records, they went down to San Antonio and recorded for them. There was an artist and repertoire man with Victor. Bluebird was a subsidiary. It was the budget label of Victor Records. The fellow's name was Eli Oberstein, and Eli Oberstein wanted Milton to perform songs that could be sold, so it was familiar songs. Milton knew all the popular songs, but Oberstein didn't want to pay royalties to anybody. He wanted to take some of the royalties for himself, so he would sometimes disguise the titles of some of the songs and call it either traditional or invent a pseudonym for songwriter's credit, and he'd end up taking it himself. You might notice some of the songs that he recorded on Bluebird had the name Dan Parker written under the song title. Well, there was no such person as Dan Parker.
The mysterious and prolific Dan Parker.
That was probably Eli Oberstein publishing the song under his own name using Dan Parker as a pseudonym.
Let's go ahead and, sorry to interrupt, but I want to go ahead and play our next song, which is Taking Off, featuring Bob Dunn on electric steel guitar. And when we come back, I want you to tell us about Bob Dunn and why he was so revolutionary. This is Taking Off by Milton Brown and the Musical Brownies, featuring Bob Dunn. Is Taking Off, which features the electric sound of Bob Dunn's steel guitar. Tell us about Bob Dunn coming onto the scene, and this was the first electric instrument recorded, correctly?
It's the first by an American, if you want to call it an American band. Actually, the first artist to amplify a guitar on record was a fellow by the name of Joseph Lopez, who played with a Hawaiian group called the Noalani Hawaiian Orchestra in I think it was early 1933, late 1932. Bob Dunn was the first Western artist, and that includes pop and jazz performers, to amplify his steel guitar. The song Taking Off, by the way, if you listen to that song very carefully, there's no melody to that song. He starts off just by playing improvisation. The chord progression is done to a Frankie Trumbauer recording of Singin' the Blues, which is a very popular Bick Spiderbeck number from the 1920s. So Bob Dunn's biggest hit didn't even have a melody that people could sing along with. Anyway, Bob Dunn, again, these great innovations happened by accident. He was a steel guitar player. He played Hawaiian music. He loved Hawaiian music. He had a correspondence going with a famous early recording artist in Hawaii who learned steel guitar for the Pan American Exposition in San Francisco in 1915. His name was Walter Kolomoku. And Walter Kolomoku had a correspondence course to teach how to play Hawaiian guitar, and Bob Dunn latched onto that. Well, Bob was kind of a hobo, and he was traveling around the country. And when he got to the boardwalk in New Jersey, in Atlantic City, he happened upon a black musician who had a little amplifier set up and was playing on the boardwalk there. Well, he figured out how to do this, how to magnetize his strings, and got an amplifier and started playing this way. And when Milton got wind of this, when Bob Dunn was a friend of Durwood's, and Durwood brought Bob in to audition for Milton at the radio station. And when he brought him in and saw what he could do, he just jumped on him and said, "You got to join this band." And Bob said, "I don't have an amplifier." So they went down to Woodward's Music Store in Mineral Wells, Texas, and Milton bought him an amplifier. And so that started Bob Dunn's appearance with the band.
And Jimmy Rogers had played with Hawaiian musicians and featured lap steel on some of his recordings, but I think you can successfully argue that it was because of Milton and Bob Dunn that steel guitar became such an integral part of first Western swing and later honky-tonk and all country and Western music.
Yeah, Bob Dunn could play the Hawaiian style, but when he amplified his guitar, he was doing Jack Teagarden. He was doing trombone work, improvising on trombone. And for the first couple of years that he was with Milton Brown, this became the style to copy throughout the Southwest. Every steel guitarist that came along, including Bob Wills' steel guitarist, Leon McAuliffe, started out by using Bob Dunn as his model. And it wasn't until Leon McAuliffe started adding more of a country sound, a pedal steel kind of sound, to steel guitar that it developed into what we now know as the pedal steel, the sound of Nashville steel guitar. But initially, it was a hotter, more staccato kind of sound to it. There wasn't too much of the sliding that was used later on. When Leon McAuliffe recorded Steel Guitar Rag with Bob Wills, in September of 1936. That started the change in the sound of the steel guitar. But all through the late 1930s, you can still hear the Bob Dunn influence.
And let's talk a little bit more about Milton's recording career. Tell us about the move to Decca Records and the recording sessions they did for Decca.
Milton was brought on board by Dave Capp, who was the A&R chief with Decca Records. He knew that Milton was the most popular band in the Southwest at the time. And he brought Milton up to Chicago to record in January of 1935. They weren't doing field sessions yet at that point. Field recording sessions began in the 1920s. In order to get to a performer's home base. Sometimes they didn't want to leave town and go to New York, and they weren't the same when they were in an urban atmosphere. They were more comfortable at home. But Milton Brown was aching to go to the big city, and so he talked to Dave Capp, and Capp paid for the whole group to travel by train up there to Chicago. They went to the Furniture Mart building, which still exists, by the way, and they recorded for several days. And Cap was delighted with the music, mainly because of the professionalism of the group. They could record all day long and never have to do a second take. Milton wasn't very happy with Eli Oberstein when he was with Bluebird, especially with the song Garbage Man Blues, which he did, in which he started off with a very complex introduction by Fred Calhoun on the piano, where he was playing 10th chords, which is kind of abrasive to the ear. And when it was time for Milton to come in with his vocal, he came in the wrong key. And they recorded the whole song, and Milton was aghast when he realized what he had done. And he told Eli Oberstein, "Can we do that one over again?" And Oberstein said, "Nah, your fans will never know the difference." And so the record came out that way, with Milton singing the whole first verse in the wrong key. So he did two sessions for Bluebird and then liked Dave Capp a lot better. Recorded for him in Chicago. And then when they started doing field recordings, the next time Decca was in the area, which was in New Orleans in March 1936, Milton drove with his band, with his bus, all the way to New Orleans, and they had a three-day recording session in March of 1936, in which they recorded 48 songs in 3 days. I mean, one of those days, he did 22 songs in one session, just went one after another. He was basically playing his dance lineup. He could just play songs all night long and never have to repeat one.
And let's hear one more. This is our last number. And this is Am I Blue, also covered by George Strait later on. And this is a needle drop from a 78, so you can get some of the feel of the scratchy sound of the 78. This is Milton Brown and the Musical Brownies doing Am I Blue.
Ain't the tears in these eyes telling you, am I blue? You'd be too, if each plan with your gal done fell through. There was a time I was her only one. Sad and lonely one, Lordy, was I gay until today. Now she's gone and with who am I blue? Yeah.
And that was Am I Blue by Milton Brown and the Musical Brownies. Some of you might recognize that from George Strait's version in the 1990s. And Milton was never sitting still. He was constantly adding musicians and dropping musicians and changing things in the lineup. Tell us a little bit about the twin fiddle approach that they developed and how that worked and why it was innovative at the time.
You know, this is something that Milton Brown actually did not innovate. He made it famous, but he wasn't the first person to do that, the first person to use twin fiddles. That was done by a little Fort Worth band called the Southern Melody Boys, which included two schooled violin players, Kenneth Pitts and Cecil Brower. Now, both of them studied with a Fort Worth symphony player by the name of Wilbert Brown. Wilbert was spelled with a Y, W-Y-L-B-E-R-T. And he wasn't related to Milton Brown. But he was a professional teacher in the Fort Worth area. And so he taught both of these guys, as well as Buck Buchanan and some other top-notch Western swing violin players, to play in harmony together. And so the Southern Melody Boys started doing this, started having these two musicians. Milton heard both of them. Kenneth Pitts was not available to go with Milton, so he brought in Cecil Brower, and Cecil Brower was added to Jesse Ashlock, and they played twin violins at that point. When Jesse Ashlock left the band, then he was replaced by Cliff Bruner. Actually, there was another violinist in between by the name of Ted Grantham, but Cliff Bruner was the key addition to the band, an amazing violin player, could play lead and harmony. And that combination of Cecil Brower and Cliff Bruner inspired many, many violinists to start playing in Texas.
And Milton experimented with horn players at various times as well.
Sure. When the occasion demanded, if he was playing a very large facility that required more volume than he could muster with just Bob Dunn's steel guitar, then he would do that. I mean, Bob Dunn, you have to realize that each musician did not have their own microphone and their own speaker. Everything was done acoustically. What Milton played with was he had a PA mic, and that's what he sang into. And when a musician had to take a solo, they'd literally step up to the microphone. That's why they were able to do these songs so quickly in the recording studio, because the recording studios used one microphone too. So they just did their dances in front of a microphone. When Bob Dunn came along, he didn't have a microphone, but he had a pickup and his own amplifier for his steel guitar. So that was the only other instrument that was amplified. Well, when they played a very, very large place that was even larger than Crystal Springs, and Milton would play for 1,000 people at a time or more, he felt the need to add louder instruments. So on occasion, he would hire a trumpet player, he might hire a saxophone, and he even had a drummer. It was very seldom, because he knew that his orchestra, his audience, really wanted to retain that rural feel, and they didn't want a big band at the time. Later on, Bob Wills would capitalize upon that, and people did started wanting it as we moved on later into the mid-1930s. And Bob Wills made horns a regular part, and drums a regular part of his band, and you have to give Wills credit for that. But for Milton, he still liked the string band sound best.
And Milton never got to develop, because he dies tragically at age 32 in a car accident after a show. Tell us some of the things that he was working on and how his heirs, Durwood Brown and Cliff Bruner in particular, carried on the Milton Brown tradition.
Milton was getting tired. He was tired of playing 6 days a week. He was tired of driving in his bus. He wanted to get off the road. And also the area around the Fort Worth vicinity was getting played out. People they weren't getting tired of him, but he wanted to explore newer audiences, and he wanted to make more money. He wanted to get into the movies. So he actually negotiated first with Gene Autry to appear in his new Western that was coming up in the spring of 1936 called Oh, Susanna. Well, of course, Milton was making so much money, he couldn't afford to leave his day-to-day existence in order to drive all the way to California to shoot this Western. So he turned down Gene Autry, and they ended up hiring the Light Crust Doughboys instead. Similarly, the big event of 1936 in Texas was the Texas Centennial Celebration, which took place in Dallas, and there was also a celebration in Fort Worth. Well, this gave Milton a great opportunity to be seen and heard by people outside of the area, people coming down to Texas. Duke Ellington was going to appear there. Sally Rand was going to bring her Nude Ranch show down there as well. And Milton was very excited at this opportunity. Once again, they couldn't afford to pay him what he wanted in order to make more money. And they ended up hiring a smaller band to play that. So the next step that he made, and this was the last step, was to move his whole operation down to Houston. He was talking to the owner of KPRC radio down there, and they'd actually struck a deal. And he was making plans to move to Houston later on in 1936 when he had his accident. So he wasn't, he was already getting antsy to leave Fort Worth and move on to bigger and better things.
And after he passes, both his brother Durwood and his fiddler Cliff Bruner go on to lead bands of their own. Durwood not as successfully. Cliff Bruner left quite a mark in musical history.
Durwood Brown was simply not the manager that Milton was. He couldn't handle his drinking as much. He wasn't as dependable. He didn't have the business acumen. And frankly, even though his band was hugely popular and musically influential, people came to see Milton Brown. And when Milton wasn't there, the dances just dried up. And within a year, Durwood had to break up the band. Now, it splintered into different factions. O.C. Stockard took some of the members and became a very popular Fort Worth group called the Wanderers. Cliff Bruner took Bob Dunn down to South Texas, and they started performing in Beaumont and then on Houston radio station KXYZ, and became very, very popular. He was an excellent band leader as well. By the late 1930s, there were new songs coming in, and Bruner had a very lasting influence on Western swing throughout the 1950s.
And Carrie, thank you so much for coming on the show. My guest has been Carrie Janelle. The book is Milton Brown and the Founding of Western Swing. And I want to thank you for coming and talking to us. But more importantly, I want to thank you for capturing this information when you did in the 90s, when so many of these people were still alive. Thank you so much for your contribution to documenting musical history.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Nate.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Next week, Nate welcomes J.D. Considine to discuss his concept of Dorian Gray music, the stuff that stays popular decade after decade and shows no signs of flagging in popularity. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.